From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for April Baer. Today, Michigan's abolitionist history doesn't tell the whole story.
The 1850 Fugitive Slave Law required citizens to participate in the recapture of freedom seekers.
A conversation with two experts on the movement of enslaved people around the state. And we'll look at the term 86, which Governor Whitmer recently threw into the political lexicon.
So I don't know that 86 will stick around as political jargon. It is clearly well entrenched as restaurant jargon.
And Big Ten football is back this weekend, but it doesn't mean that this is a return to normal.
There won't be any marching band, there are no cheerleaders, no mascots, no tailgating outside. And I know this will make you sad, no Zeke the Wonder Dog catching frisbees.
Those conversations and more ahead on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, sitting in for April Baer. Today, a Black family who's lived in Cadillac for years wonders if there's still a place for them in rural northern Michigan. That's coming up later on the show. But first, Big Ten football returns this weekend. But like all sports during the pandemic, it isn't going to have the same pomp and circumstance that we're all used to. Here to explain is John Neo, columnist for the Detroit News. John, welcome back to Stateside.
Well, thanks for having me, Laura.
So what will Big Ten football look like this year?
What will it feel like? What will it sound like are the things that, to me, make it even stranger. It's going to be different, obviously. Empty stadiums, they're going to let families of players in to a certain extent, you know, up to maybe 1,000 people in the stadium. But we're used to 75,000 in Spartan Stadium and 100,000 plus in Michigan Stadium and Ohio Stadium. It's going to feel different. It's going to sound different. They'll have piped in crowd noise. But, you know, college football, you know, the pageantry, if you will, of it is a lot of the sights and sounds. And so you won't have, there won't be any marching band. There are no cheerleaders, no mascots, no tailgating outside. And I know this will make you sad. No Zeke the Wonder Dog catching frisbees at Spartan Stadium.
Oh, so sad.
I don't know. I did see his owner was on Twitter making a last minute plea this week, but no, they're restricting access and making it just players only, essentially essential employees, if you will.
So my husband said that with no crowd or band nor cheerleaders, it's going to feel like watching a scrimmage. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah. And the players have talked about it. They've done some sort of trial runs, both for the players and the coaches, et cetera, just to get used to it. You know, they will pipe in crowd noise as they're doing in the NFL, but it's a different, obviously, level of noise and kind of noise. But it's also, it's the whole game day routine changes. You know, Michigan State's not going to have their players, you know, the walk to the stadium. Some of those traditions that, you know, I think fans love and certainly the players and coaches love are not going to be part of it. But they are going to play the games, and that's what they were clamoring for all, you know, summer and fall. And so I think they're willing to take these restrictions if it means they still get to go out and play these games.
I think the question for me is whether anyone wants to watch that. And, you know, there had been a lot of bemoaning of the lack of sports when everything was shut down in the spring. But then slowly, like, you know, tennis and baseball and then basketball and eventually football began to slowly return. Have the ratings returned with the sports now that they're so dramatically different?
Across the board, the numbers have been down, and there's sort of conflicting reasons or explanations as to why that may be. Although I will say the NFL numbers have been what you would expect, you know, from NFL TV ratings numbers. So in that sense, I think college football also will fall into that same category. Football is America's pastime, whether baseball wants to admit it or not. And you know, you've got these schools, fan bases that are just, you know, desperate to see their alma mater play or whatever the case may be. So I think the numbers will bear that out. And, you know, we had a glut of sports all of a sudden. You mentioned it. There was no sports, and all of a sudden there was too much sports almost on TV. And I think that was part of the ratings decline. But some of it's, you know, some of the social justice campaigns and things like that maybe have turned people off. And it just may be that people just don't want, like you said, don't want to watch a sort of more sterile, sort of strange scene.
So University of Michigan may be fielding a football team this weekend, but Washtenaw County issued a 2-week quarantine for all undergrads because of the spread of COVID in the area, especially among younger college students in social gatherings. So the optics aren't really great as far as I'm concerned. But Is there a reasonable argument to be made that you have to prevent all kids in college from gathering except the football team, which is obviously a moneymaker for the university?
Yeah, no, and certainly the optics are good. But they knew that going in when they decided. I mean, the Big Ten presidents and chancellors punted the season back in mid-August and then sort of caved a little bit under pressure a month or so ago to bring it back as other conferences went ahead and played. The difference in their defense, I guess, the difference is the players are undergoing and staff, et cetera, are undergoing daily antigen testing. That's the exemption that was carved out there in that recent order from Washtenaw County. But you mentioned it. Look, I mean, cases are spiking across the upper Midwest, and yet here the Big Ten is starting, kicking off its season this weekend in the middle of maybe another surge. The optics aren't good. I mean, you had a dozen mayors of Big Ten cities send a humble letter. I think what humble was the word they used, but sort of asking the Big Ten to coordinate better and not schedule late afternoon and night games because they're worried about crowds, bars, parties.
So did the Big Ten respond? Are they going to have any night games?
I think it's safe to say they will because their TV contracts almost stipulate it. TV is still driving this bus in many respects, and that TV revenue, I mean, it's tens of millions of dollars. So I think their pleas will fall on deaf ears in some respects.
John Neo is a columnist with the Detroit News. John, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
A few days ago, Governor Gretchen Whitmer made a few waves during a television interview from her home with Meet the Press. Tucked discreetly in the corner of the screen on a table just behind Whitmer's right shoulder is a small figure of two double-digit numbers, 86 and 45. The meaning behind 45 would be the 45th president, Donald Trump. The number 86 you may have heard used in a restaurant. In a commercial kitchen, it means we're all out of something. So 86-45 would mean, essentially, done with Donald Trump. Some Republicans wondered if Whitmer was sending a nefarious or even violent message. Here to explain the humble beginnings of the term 86 is Ann Curzan. She's dean of LS&A at the University of Michigan. And welcome back to Stateside.
A pleasure.
So for me, when I hear 86, I immediately am back in a commercial kitchen as a waitress and bartender and thinking about the head chef telling us what items we no longer have available on our menu. Where does the term 86 begin? Does it begin in the kitchen?
It does. It begins with soda fountains, from what we can tell. So tell me a little bit more. When you were working as a server, how would you hear the term used?
We would walk into the kitchen and the chef or the sous chef would say, 86 lamb. And then it would just go down the line, 86 lamb, 86 lamb, 86 lamb. So everybody knew not to offer it from that moment forward.
I love it. Right. So 86 lamb means we're out of lamb.
Yep, exactly.
And this is what it has meant since the 1930s, which is when we have the first evidence for it. It is from soda fountain lingo, the lunch counters and the soda jerks behind the counter. And in 1933, this man named Walter Winchell was writing a column about soda fountain lingo. And in it, he includes 86 and says it means all out of it. And about 3 years later, we see a piece in the journal American Speech, which is interested in developments in American dialects. And it is in an article called Linguistic Concoctions of the Soda Jerker. And it has a few different ones. So, for example, 81 is a glass of water, and 95 is a customer walking out without paying. And 86 is an item on the menu is not on hand.
So we know where it starts, but do we know why?
We don't. There is a lot of speculation about where this comes from, including the idea that at the Empire State Building, the elevator takes you up to the 86th floor and it lets you out and you must 86 out of the elevator. Or there was a bar called Chumley's in Greenwich Village that was at 86 Bedford Street. And the idea is that during the Prohibition, if all the patrons needed to get out, they would yell 86 and people would leave. Or if someone got drunk and got thrown out, they would be lying on the sidewalk looking up at the bar sign and 86 because it was at 86 Bedford Street. There is not evidence that any of that is true. One of the more persuasive explanations is that this is rhyming slang. And it is rhyming slang for nix.
Yeah, like get rid of it.
Yeah, nix that. We don't have any more of that. So nix the lamb. We don't have any more. And rhyming slang is often playful. And so you get 86 because it rhymes with nix.
So if we're talking about 86 as being getting rid of somebody, perhaps throwing them out of a bar if they were intoxicated, et cetera, could it be perceived as a threat?
It is more common to see 86 used in these sort of restaurant ways of someone getting kicked out or their job is ended. But there is some evidence that sometimes it is used to mean to kill. It might be influenced by the phrase to deep six, which is used sometimes to refer to death. So it's not impossible that people could interpret it that way.
So you've seen various phrases come and go in popularity, especially in political circles where I think lawmakers tend to glom on to what each other are saying, kick the can down the road, chew gum and walk at the same time. You know, they all kind of start to say these phrases and they come and go, fall in and out of favor. Do you see 86 falling into a political category for a while?
I'm terrible at predicting these sort of things. So I don't know that 86 will stick around as political jargon. It is clearly well entrenched as restaurant jargon.
Ann Curzan, thank you so much for explaining this term for us.
Absolutely.
Ann Curzan is the Dean of LS&A at University of Michigan. Coming up next, Michigan was known as a hotbed for abolitionist activity in the decades leading up to the Civil War. But that doesn't mean that life was easy for the African Americans living here. That's next. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for April Baer. When it comes to race relations, Michigan has quite a mixed history. Yes, Michigan was a hotbed of abolitionist activity, including the founding of the Anti-Slavery Republican Party in Jackson. And Michigan was part of the Underground Railroad movement, with many freedom seekers striving to get to Canada. On the flip side, following the Civil War and into the 20th century, Michigan was home to numerous sundown towns where African Americans feared for their lives after sunset. Just what was the experience for African Americans in Michigan prior to the Civil War? April Baer recently spoke to two experts. Here she is to introduce them.
Annalisa Cox is a PhD and a non-resident fellow with the Hutchins Center at Harvard University. She's currently doing history research in Michigan. Annalisa, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
We're also talking with Deandra Johnson. She's Midwest Regional Coordinator for the Network to Freedom program, part of the National Parks Service. Day, welcome to Stateside.
Yes, thank you for having me.
You know, there's a story that's been making the rounds in some white churches in Michigan, that this state was a near nirvana for freedom seekers. And the way the narrative goes, no freedom seekers who made it to Michigan from slavery in the South were returned to slavery because towns and churches had this system. If slave catchers were nearby, the churches would ring their bells to give warning. Have either of you ever heard this story? And do you know if there's any truth to it?
No, I have never heard that story before in any capacity. And so that's a very interesting, but there were freedom seekers who made it to Michigan that were returned. One of the most famous kind of incidences that happened was here in Michigan was in 1841 with Nelson Hackett. And he actually escaped from Arkansas and made it to Canada. And actually, his slave owners came to Michigan and were able to get the governor to issue an extradition order to bring him back from Canada to Michigan. And it's quite an involved story that happened. But it's interesting that the Canadian government actually pushed back against the request for extradition, saying that Michigan could not make the request as Hackett had escaped from Arkansas. But the Canadian government ended up extraditing him, not because he escaped from slavery, but because he had taken with him other articles of his owner's or slaveholder's property with him. So I think no state in the Northwest Territory was altogether anti-slavery. There was always a different mix of ideas and people. People were pro-slavery. There's other cases that happened here in Michigan where people were returned to slavery. But there also was, at the same time, even if a decision was made to return them to slavery, there were segments of the population, most often members of the African American population, that really provided resistance to this type of return. And so I think it's important to really note African-American resistance to this movement, because when we look at kind of traditional constructions of the Underground Railroad, it's usually constructed in terms of white benevolence. And African-Americans are made kind of secondary characters in stories that are largely about their own struggles for self-determination and freedom. So I think that's an all an interesting dimension of Underground Railroad in Michigan, because you do have such an outpouring of African-American activity, both who had achieved their freedom either legally or extra-legally by escaping in other means.
As one of the states that borders Canada, I've got to believe that just the geographic position of Michigan probably made it a pretty important spot. Were there other factors that contributed to that as well?
Yeah, I think transportation networks, both when the railroad came, but both the Great Lakes, it being on the Great Lakes, and so that shipping industry, and I think Annalisa can talk to you more about that.
Well, this is something that a few maritime specialists in Michigan and the Midwest are just beginning to explore. One of the things we forget is that the Great Lakes used to be filled with ships. It was the best way of traveling around before the Civil War. And those ships had African-American staff members on them. So they were working those ships. They were extremely expert. And they were helping freedom seekers to escape aboard those ships. And that was happening around the UP. It was happening in all of the Great Lakes. So this was an underground railroad that was also used the waterways to escape. And one of the important points to make is that Michigan was actually a very much a frontier state. And there were, of course, indigenous people here before the Civil War, but a lot of the state was not settled. I mean, in 1830, the entire non-indigenous population of this state was 31,000 people. So freedom seekers, of course, were not protected by a series of church bells. There were no church bells across the state of Michigan that could even hear each other, right, before the Civil War. So that argument doesn't even have a very strong historical sense about what the state looked like before the Civil War. And what it looked like was mainly rural, no big cities, and people who were trying to seek freedom in this border state. Sometimes their freedom was being resisted by white Michiganders.
Was it common for whole communities to stand together in Michigan? I'm thinking of the 1847 Kentucky raid in Battle Creek, which is one of the positive stories. I mean, can we say that communities across Michigan were largely of one mind, either for or against slavery?
Dale, I'll let you answer that one, because, of course, there's also the Cass County 47 raid as well. Yeah.
Yeah, and actually, they're connected. They're not separate events. So what happened was that this group of slave catchers and slave holders from Kentucky came into Michigan looking for their property. They first went to Battle Creek, and a resistance movement was led by Erastus Hussey, who was a Quaker, who propelled them back. That group went back to Indiana, and then they got further intel about where the freedom seekers were, and that led them to Cass County, and then that raid broke out there. And so in both the Battle Creek and the Cass County raid, you have this connection with those that are providing the resistance, in addition to the free Blacks that have already settled in these places, you also have these Quaker communities also bolstering this resistance to these Kentucky raiders. So I think that's an interesting thing. And I think in other communities that you also have some resistance, but there always is a mix. Like, there might be a majority, but there's always some outliers. So one of the events I'm thinking of is in that same year, earlier in the year, is the Crosswhite Family Affair. And that was in Marshall, Michigan. And you mentioned bells, and that is an incident where slave catchers from Kentucky came up into Calhoun County, where Marshall is located, and attempted to recapture a family, Adam, Sarah, and their four children, and take them back to Kentucky. They were first propelled back. They broke into the Crosswhites' home, attempted to capture them. They were propelled back by the African-American community there, who provided resistance. And one of the kind of, I don't know, myths or kind of the folklore of it is that an African-American man who rang the bell at the local auctions went down the streets ringing the bell, alerting people to the fact that these slave hunters were in the area. And then members of the white population also provided resistance to these slave catchers, arresting them and putting them in jail for kidnapping and other crimes, et cetera, et cetera. And I think this makes one of the difficulties about African Americans really protecting their freedom is that they did not have those same protections under the law. Search and seizure, all those things did not apply to them that we now, you know, our touchstones and our Bill of Rights was really hard for African Americans to be protected under those same things that we now, you know, consider inviolate. And so I think that's one of the interesting things that happens there. But of course, in Detroit, you have a lot of community resistance there. But Detroit is going to be a mix of people, both pro-slavery and anti-slavery. So I think it's hard to say, like, you do have a community where the balance is leans more to one side. But I don't know if you can ever say an entire community is one way or the other.
If you're just joining us, we're talking today with Day Johnson, Midwest Regional Coordinator for the Network to Freedom Program for the National Park Service, and with Annalisa Cox, a non-resident fellow with the Hutchins Center at Harvard University. Were there ways, Day Johnson, that information was communicated along the Underground Railroad about towns or areas that freedom seekers should avoid or might be safe in?
Yeah, and it's hard to know those communication patterns. What's interesting is that most African Americans sought out first communities of color, and then from their networks, it spread out into getting white assistance. And that's usually the way that it happened. But I mean, it's so hard. And this is one of the questions that I would think needs further investigation, is that there seems to be a lot of back and forth between people who made it to the North and people who were in the South. And I think we have not even begun to grasp those communication systems, because one of the interesting things that we're noticing is that people who escaped from an area at different points in time all end up settling eventually in the same places in the North. And so there has to be some communication system. What that is it word of mouth? Are people able to write letters to certain people? This is not in Michigan, but we know with Harriet Tubman that she wrote letters to someone that was free. And then from there, the information was disseminated about escaping and different things like that. So I think we have not even begun to like scratch the surface of these vast communication networks. And one of the interesting things that I was looking at is how important postmasters were. I was reading a letter from an abolitionist, and he writes about his excitement that they got a postmaster, and the postmaster was of an anti-slavery ilk. And he says, this means I will be able to communicate more freely. And we don't think about postmasters today being able to read information about, you know, read your mail, essentially. So that communication network seems to be important if we glean that from that letter I told you that came from that anti-slavery activist about the postmaster.
I wonder if either of you think that it's a stretch to compare the systems that developed under the Underground Railroad to those people who today might help immigrants coming north from Michigan who might be on the run from ICE or other federal officials.
Yeah, so that's a really interesting question, April. One of the ways that we can think about it is those people who are trying to stand up to ICE are not particularly popular. There's not a whole lot of them. And I think that one of the lessons we can draw from the past is that this is not the vast majority of Michiganders who were involved in the Underground Railroad. And it was not a hugely popular movement before the Civil War. And in fact, there were a lot of white Michiganders who thought that they were upholding the federal law by capturing freedom seekers and returning them to the South. They thought of themselves as law-abiding citizens, returning property to where it goes. And these are horrific words to us today, but I think it's really important to remember that this was not a fashionable movement or a popular movement in the state of Michigan. And Day made mention of the fact that this was particularly risky work for people of African descent in the state of Michigan before the Civil War because they had so little protection under the law. And I think it's really important for us to remember in this election year, as we move towards an election, that a majority of white Michiganders opposed equal representation and the right to vote for their African American neighbors in the state of Michigan, even though when Michigan was first carved out and became part of the United States in 1787, African Americans were promised the right to vote in this region when it was still a territory. And that promise was broken and that right was stolen by white Michiganders in 1819, when the first territorial government document was written up and they excluded African Americans from the right to vote and the right to vote for who would represent them in 1819. And that right to vote continued to be opposed by white Michiganders through the Civil War, a Civil War in which African Americans from Michigan fought and died for the liberty of all people in the United States. And it was, in fact, in 1867, a new constitution for the state of Michigan was written and was turned down by a majority of white Michiganders. And that new constitution included the right for Black people to vote, and it was turned down. It was in 1867. So we have to remember this isn't just about slavery versus freedom. This is also about equality versus prejudice. And these are issues that people in the state of Michigan have wrestled with for a long time and continue to wrestle with.
Day, what do you wish more people understood about the way the Underground Railroad worked in Michigan?
That's a hard one. I think Dr. Cox brought up some really good points about, you know, we assume because a place was anti-slavery, had Underground Railroad activity, that people were for pro-Black or for Black equality, and that's not the case. I think we also have to remember that slavery existed in Michigan. And so they had these prohibitions against slavery, but slavery existed in what would become the state of Michigan. And so when you have slavery, these ideas that help to bolster it, these ideas of prejudice and racism, don't disappear. And I think it's important that we realize that, because also it's important to realize that because we have Michigan also being a destination, not only because people escaping from the South, but before in the 1700s and early 1800s, you have people escaping from Canada, where slavery was illegal, to Michigan for freedom. And so I don't think people really grapple with that idea either, that people actually escaping from the North to the South, which would Michigan, or depending on where you are in Michigan, if it's North or South, that people were escaping to Michigan from Canada. And so I think that's one of the things that I think people don't understand, that just how pervasive slavery was. We tend to create this false dichotomy, right? North is free, South is a slave, and the two never meet. But actually, slavery was quite pervasive, not only in North America, period. And so I think this has done a really great disservice to our understanding of just how instrumental and pervasive this was in our country. And that's why the Underground Railroad stands out. When you think about just how pervasive slavery was, that there were people who were willing to risk their own lives to either escape or to assist others, I think it makes it just, even if they were a small part of the population, I think it magnifies their efforts and shows that even in the roughest, in the most strenuous times, there are things that people did. They worked together across bounds of race, gender, religious organizations to believe, because they believed that they were righting something that was wrong. And I think this is one of the first grassroots movements of our country. And even today, people still, the Underground Railroad is a touchstone for current day social justice movements. And if, you know, there's all these arguments as, was the Underground Railroad successful? And I think it depends about how you look at it. But for each of those lives it touched, I would say it was a great success. It gave them opportunities, even if the places that they went to weren't free from racial strife, it gave them opportunities that they otherwise would have never have had.
Dandra Johnson is Midwest Regional Coordinator for the National Park Service's Network to Freedom program within the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center. We've also been talking with Annalisa Cox, PhD, with the Hutchins Center at Harvard University. She is sited in Michigan for now. Annalisa, Day, it's really great to hear your voices. Thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
Thank you for this opportunity.
In a year of racial reckoning, a Black family in northern Michigan wonders if they are still welcome there.
I start asking the Lord, please guide me out. Please, Lord.
That's after a short break. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for April Bear. We cover a lot on Stateside every day, from politics to arts and the environment. But we always want to know what you'd like to hear on the airwaves. Is there a story impacting your community that you think deserves our attention? Or maybe you just want to let us know your thoughts on a conversation that you heard. Either way, we'd love to hear from you. You can email us at stateside@michiganradio.org. You can also connect with us on Twitter. We're at Stateside Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for April Bear. Northern Michigan is mostly white and rural. If you're Black, like Dilla Scott and her three children, life up north can be hard. They say they've been harassed over their 30 years living up north, but they've endured. But now the arrest of a family member has shaken their conviction, and they are wondering if it's time to go. Interlochen Public Radio's Max Johnston has their story.
Back in early January, 24-year-old Alex Marshall and his family went to church. They go every Sunday. It's a ritual. This time, they decided to have Chinese food afterwards. Alex went to pick it up while his family waited at home. After getting the food, Alex was on his way back. A City of Cadillac police cruiser was behind him. When Alex eventually parked in front of his mother's house, the officer pulled in too. He didn't flash his lights, so Alex wasn't sure whether or not he was getting pulled over. Alex got out of his car. The police officer stepped out of his car too and approached him. The following is from a video Alex recorded on his cell phone.
There's an issue?
Huh?
Is there an issue?
Take your hand out of your pocket. We'll start there.
No, we ain't got to take nothing out of my pocket.
The officer said Alex ran a stop sign a few blocks back.
Okay, why you didn't put me over back there? You just followed me all the way over here, went down there, and kept on standing.
Alex walked away from the police officer. He went around his car to get the food. The officer asked Alex to stop moving. He said he saw Alex stumble as he got out of his car and that he was being investigated for drunk driving. Alex said he did nothing wrong and that he was going inside.
Have a good day, sir. Have a good day.
Then things escalate. Alex reached inside his passenger seat to get the food. The officer approached him and grabbed his arms.
Don't touch me. Please don't touch me. Officer, why are you touching me?
Because you're not obeying my
orders. You put your lights on me, dude. Get off of me.
I'm telling your details.
Get off of me.
The officer got his arms around Alex and eventually wrestled him to the ground.
What the f*** are you doing? What the f*** are you doing?
Alex drops his phone in the snow, but it does keep recording.
Okay, I failed.
You fall out of your vehicle?
I failed because it's slippery.
I'm investigating you for drunk driving. That's what I am stopping you for.
You didn't even stop me, dude. I was already out of my car.
You failed to identify yourself.
Dude, you didn't even.
You would not obey my commands.
Dude, get
off me. Resisting.
The officer later wrote that he did not smell alcohol on Alex's breath while he was being arrested, but he says he couldn't check for other signs of intoxication because Alex wasn't complying.
My kids are out here. Are you kidding me, dude?
Dude, I'll reach anything.
Okay, you can get me. I'm gonna get up.
The officer held Alex down on the ground. His mother and his two young children stood a few feet away, watching him getting taken away.
What did I do? Dude, what the
can I do? Are you kidding me?
What you do?
Are you kidding me?
You're making a show in front of your kids. What you do?
Am I really dumb? You just grabbed me for no reason. What the are you doing? Mom, call my lady right now. I'm calling you. You motherfucker harassed me 24/7. Did you even fucking play that time?
Take care of baby.
The Cadillac Police Department says this arrest was handled properly. They say their officer was responding to another call when he saw Alex run several stop signs. When the officer pulled up behind him and asked Alex to stop moving, Director of Public Safety Adam Otjepka said he was being lawfully detained and Alex didn't follow the officer's orders. He says they wouldn't change anything about the arrest, except for one thing.
The officer instructed him why he was there, why he was making contact with him, that he was lawfully being detained, and Alex Marshall continued to not listen to the officer's lawful orders. And I wish Alex Marshall would have just complied with the officer.
Two charges against Alex, disorderly conduct and obstructing police, were later dismissed by the county prosecutor. A rep from their office said they had to prioritize other more serious cases during the pandemic. Alex's mother, Dilla Scott, says the night of his arrest was one of the worst of her life. Dilla held her grandchildren, Alex's two young daughters, for hours while they cried.
That night,
yeah, we don't know.
I felt I really wanted to retaliate. That night, I couldn't sleep.
So Dilla did what she does every night. She prayed. She says faith is her survival and that the Lord speaks to her. She says he's guided her all her life. Decades earlier, Dilla says God told her to move to Michigan. Later, in response to her prayers, she says God told her to start a life here in Cadillac. So she did. But that night, Dilla says he said something to her that she had never heard before. Dilla moved the family to northern Michigan about 30 years ago. They settled in Idlewild in Lake County to be near family. At one time, Idlewild was called the Black Eden of Michigan. In the early to mid-20th century, it was an economic and creative haven for black people in the Midwest. But by the time the family moved there, Idlewild had changed. Residents and entrepreneurs left for bigger markets. Economic opportunities dried up. A place that would attract 25,000 visitors on any given weekend now had a population of less than 1,000. There, Dilla says, she worried about her kids falling in with the wrong crowd.
Idlewild means the men are idle and the women are wild. You could go right around the corner and there are those people who are disruptive to their own community, to themselves and to others.
So a few years later, she packed up the family. They moved around for a few years, but eventually found Cadillac, where Dilla remembers being impressed. The lakeside community was beautiful. There was a thriving downtown. She thought it would be a great place for her family to settle. But she says there was one problem. Cadillac's reputation on race. In 2005, a group of neo-Nazis were given a certificate from the city for cleaning up a public park. Just last year, the city paid a $90,000 settlement to a black teenager that said he was racially profiled by a police officer. And that's just recent history. Dilla had heard these stories for years.
Some were misinterpreted and some were true. But I didn't want to be bothered. I wanted to take my children and skip on down the road. But God wasn't having it. And I learned a long time ago to be obedient to him.
They settled in Cadillac. After bouncing around for so many years, Dilla felt it could be a fresh start for them. But her family quickly experienced this racism firsthand. Her son Alex was jumped by white classmates in grade school, and he nearly went to juvie for defending himself. Dilla's daughter Angel was called the N-word when she walked to the bus stop. Dilla says she still experiences racism almost every day. She admits it's exhausting, but the Lord kept telling her to stay in Cadillac.
I'm watching my children in pain, and it seems so unfair, but Jesus tells me to stay, and there was times when I even questioned him. He said, it's okay to question me, but do as I say. But he blessed me with strength for us to keep going.
Dilla always told her kids to respond to that racism with a forgiving heart.
That's very important. You forgive people for the wrong that they're doing. And don't hold that anger in. Let it go. Just throw it over your back and keep walking.
For Alex, that's her youngest, Dilla's message of forgiveness stuck.
I guess I'm the one they say is too forgiving.
Dilla says even from a young age, Alex didn't seem to want to leave Cadillac.
I don't think I would have as much love if I didn't experience as much hate as I did.
But that strategy didn't work for Angel, Dilla's middle child and only daughter.
I mean, she could tell me that over and over again, and I wasn't forgiven at all. I believe in killing people with kindness to a certain extent, but in order to understand how I feel, you gotta feel my pain. Just like you hurt me, I'm gonna wanna hurt you too.
Angel says experiencing that racism gave her thick skin. And because of what she endured in Cadillac, she closed herself off to the world. She says she doesn't let people in. Angel was sick of Cadillac and the racism she experienced there from day one. So sick of it that she moved out of the house when she was 18 and brought Alex with her. Even though it broke her mother's heart, Angel was thrilled to leave. She moved about an hour away to Mount Pleasant. But Alex kept coming back to Cadillac.
No, you didn't even stay a full 6 months. You were like in Mount Pleasant and you kept coming. Like he was back here every day. He was doing the everyday trips for real.
Alex is conflicted on whether or not to stay in Cadillac. He's considered leaving, but says the town is getting safer and his family may be playing a role. For instance, after Alex was jumped by classmates in grade school, the staff had to take diversity and inclusion training. And years later, classmates that harassed them have apologized. Black friends and neighbors confide in the family when they feel targeted or isolated.
I feel like God got me, like, he really got me here for a reason. I moved multiple times, and he's bringing me back maybe to help people of color feel okay up here, make them feel that they're welcomed up here. Maybe I'm sitting here to help.
Bring that positive energy.
Bring that positive energy or bring that love back to the community and unity back to the community.
Alex is known for the parties and events he throws around town and the sermons he delivers over Facebook Live. After George Floyd was killed in the custody of Minneapolis police, Alex organized a peaceful protest in Cadillac in June. A few hundred people of different races and ethnicities showed up in solidarity. There's even a photo of Alex kneeling and locking arms with a Cadillac police officer that went viral. The people that showed their support gave the family hope that Cadillac could change. Angel thinks their presence here has made that possible. But for her, that's not enough to keep them here.
I know it's not gonna change in a day. I know that, but it could change without me being here. I don't have to be here for it to change. I made my mark, so.
The change is in motion. Nobody can stop it now. It's in motion.
Dilla's perspective on Cadillac changed when Alex was arrested right in front of her. She says she no longer trusts the police. She no longer trusts some of her neighbors. She says in many ways, she no longer trusts Cadillac.
It took away a lot of my comfort. It took away a lot of it. And, I don't feel safe when I go places anymore.
And so that night, the night of Alex's arrest, after putting her crying grandchildren to bed, Dilla prayed. She asked again about what to do, whether she and her family should stay. For years, for decades, the answer had always been, yes, stay. But that night, Dilla says the Lord spoke to her again, this time with a new message.
I started asking the Lord, please guide me out. Please, Lord, get me out of here. And the Lord told me, he said, I will at my time. I know that when God tell me to go, I'm going. He won't have to tell me twice.
The disorderly conduct and obstruction charges against Alex from that January arrest have since been dismissed. Angel is ready to leave Cadillac. She's already moved about an hour away, but she wants to go even farther.
I won't get up, and I could be in Texas, and in a year, I end up in South Carolina. I'm just that type of person.
I don't know.
So they go follow me wherever I go.
Excuse me, she's lying. I'm not following her.
Alex may not want to follow, but he also wants to leave soon. He's not sure where he'll go or when. He just wants to see what else is out there for him. But he may not go far, because Cadillac still has a pull on him.
Maybe open a business. I really want to open a business here. I don't know why it's just stuck on me to open a business here. But in 5 years, I plan on being the mayor of Cadillac. I really do.
In Traverse City, I'm Max Johnston.
This weekend, CBS News Magazine 60 Minutes plans to run longtime journalist Leslie Stahl's interview with President Trump. Perhaps you already heard about this interview, or maybe you've even heard segments from it. And that's because it was widely reported that President Trump abruptly left the interview about half an hour into it, frustrated with the line of questioning from Stahl. What you may not know is that President Trump's frustration boiled over during questions about Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer. The White House posted this recording of the interview taken for posterity.
So you don't want to lock up Governor Whitmer, but you want to lock up.
When did I say lock her up? I never
said. The Bidens, you want to lock up.
Wait a minute, when did I say lock her up? When did I say lock up the governor? I didn't say lock up the governor.
All right, but you.
Why would I lock her up? No, but why did you say you don't want to lock up the governor? Of course I don't want to lock her up. Why would I lock her up?
Because you were in front of a rally of people saying it, encouraging it.
I never said it, Leslie.
A minute later, the frustrated Trump removes his mic and walks out.
Well, I think we have enough. Really, we have enough of it.
I think we're ready for the vice president now.
I think we have enough of an interview here. Okay, that's enough. Let's go.
But a note here about what the president was saying. While rallying in Muskegon last week, he said this.
You got to get your governor to open up your state, okay? And get your schools open. Get your schools open. The schools have to be open.
The crowd chanted, lock her up, about Whitmer. And then the president said this.
Lock her up. Lock them all up.
Lock them all up. Semantics, maybe, but enough to frustrate the president and cut short an interview with 60 Minutes, which airs this Sunday. You know, sometimes what you really need to bring today's news into context is a little history, and sometimes it's coverage of breaking stories that help you feel like you better understand. Well, we here at Stateside are revamping our daily podcast to help you make sense of it all. We're coming out with this new podcast on Monday. It launches Monday, October 26th. If you're already subscribed to the Stateside podcast, wonderful. You don't have to do anything. But if you're not yet, just find us wherever you listen to podcasts, download the Stateside podcast, and we'll be happy for you to hear the new version of it on Monday. And that's our show for today. I'm Laura Weber Davis. Thanks so much for listening. Our producers are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and our director is Mercedes Mejia. Interns are Catherine Newhan, Nell Ovitt, and Olive Scott. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. April Bear will be back on Monday. We'll see you then.